Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of A Climate Hawk's Companion, your source for perspective and insight on topics related to global warming. In this episode, we're joined by Fran McIntyre, our legal expert here at the Climate Hawks Companion. And we're discussing a court case that's come up recently here in Massachusetts. For those of you in the know, and if you don't know, I'll explain it to you. Massachusetts in 2008 passed a law called the Global Warming Solutions Act. And that law mandated that the state put together a plan to reduce carbon emissions all the way down to 80% below previous levels by the year 2050. That process is ongoing, but the state has only set aspirational standards. The recent court case has come up in which basically a set of young teenagers, because they'll be around in 2050, coupled with the Conservation Law Foundation, have asked that the state forced to put numerical targets, actual regulations to control carbon emissions here in the state. That court case is predicated on a legal concept that has a long history. It's called the public trust doctrine. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So, Fran, can you explain to me what the public trust doctrine is, where it comes from, and what legitimacy it has in American law?
Sure. First, to understand that it's a doctrine or a theory, Chad, what it really means is that it's an accepted legal solution to a legal problem. And a legal problem that the public trust doctrine solved is of ancient origin, going back to the time of Magna Carta. And you'll recall and probably would understand that the sovereign, the crown, the king in Great Britain owned all the land. And he could give the land to persons that he chose to give it to. But it quickly became apparent that if he gave away the land that had access to the water, he would be depriving the population of access to the water, and water was a necessity for human survival. Specifically, it became clear that if his friends were given the shorefront and were given complete access to ponds and rivers, that the population couldn't use it for fishing and cooking and bathing and drinking and all the necessities of human life. That would certainly have implications for the crown in the long run, and it became quickly established that the shorefront, in particular, and great ponds, they were called, large-sized ponds, could only be held subject to the understanding that the public would continue to have access for fishing, fowling, hunting, bathing, whatever necessities. And so it's a property law concept, and it comes with the understanding that the interest in land can be divided, that the ownership, the title of the land can be held by one person, but the use of the land can be given to another person. And so while title was held by the crown to the shorefront, the public was given the use of it. The United States and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in particular adopted the common law of England at the time of the founding. And so that brought it in that the Commonwealth then owned all the land and owned the shorefront. It's familiar to many of us, with the understanding that the public has access to the shorefront, that is, the area between the high tide line and the low tide line, and that the public has a right of access to be in that area. That is the public trust doctrine.
Which goes in all the way back to the Magna Carta, if not before, but says that, you know, these specific areas, as you say, the waterfront is held in as a trust with that everyone has to have access to it, basically.
That's right.
And there are multiple uses for this, but that they're all held in common. Okay.
And almost all around water. almost all around water. I would say exclusively it's around water issues in particular that this public trust doctrine has come to be understood.
Over the past 200 years here in the United States?
Much longer than that, 400 or 500 years. But in this country, certainly, it's of longstanding.
Okay, so then there is a court case brought based on the public law, the public trust doctrine, that addresses whether or not the state has a responsibility to limit carbon pollution because of the obvious long-term climate damage. So does that have credibility in the court? I mean, number one, is it a believable argument? Is it something that the court might accept, or how would that play in a court if it was actually, which it actually is being argued?
Well, it just, you have to look at what is the legal problem in the case that you're referring to, the Massachusetts case, I think they're calling it the Our Children's Trust case because of the child plaintiffs that are involved there. The public trust doctrine is cited by the plaintiff in seeking relief, but the greater part of the argument is actually based upon the statute that the legislature in Massachusetts passed, directing the Department of Environmental Protection to do certain things with regard to carbon emissions, the Global Warming Solutions Act. That's correct. So the legislature orders the DEP to take certain actions under the GWSA. And so these child plaintiffs then come into court and request that the court order mandate or what's called a writ of mandamus. That's an ancient writ. It's called a writ of mandamus to mandate that the DEP do what the child plaintiffs say the GWSA requires. Now, the difference between the parties is, what does the GWSA require? The statute says by its terms, the Department of Environmental Protection is to set desired levels of emissions. The child plaintiffs argue that desired level of emissions means a mandated, sanctionable, enforceable standard. The Department of Environmental Protection says desired level means something that's aspirational, just a target, not a mandated sanctionable standard. That's really what the case rests on, is an interpretation of what a desired level means. Now, the child plaintiffs also argue behind...
When you say the child plaintiffs are 14 teenagers out of, I think it's Wellesley and Dorchester or something, that are the kids claim they will be harmed in the future if the DEP doesn't do the right thing, right?
So that's just correct.
Everyone knows when we say child plaintiffs.
They're not
little waifs out of Les Miserables drifting into court.
But that's how the case has become known. They are represented as all children must be by their next friend who would be their parent, and of course they're accompanied by the two advocacy groups, the CLF and the other. So just to make it clear, that's what their claim is, that their future is going to be impacted if the DEP does not carry out what the plaintiffs say. The GWSA says, but they also argue behind the GWSA argument, they also include the public trust doctrine by citing to Article 97, which is part of the Declaration of Rights of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And they claim that Article 97, which guarantees to the public the right to clean air, is another reason why the court ought to mandate that DEP take this action. So,
if you back up for one second, Fred, Article 97 of the Massachusetts Constitution, which of course is the oldest written constitution in the world, was that written by John Adams himself? I mean, back in 1776, was that one put in, or was it later?
No, the Constitution, of course, was written by John Adams himself, but there have been amendments and additions to it over the years. Article 97 was added, I think it's around 1973, about the same time as the Clean Air Act, when there was concern about air pollution first being expressed back in those early days. And so it's a right to clean air. It's not exclusively clean air. It also is a right to other natural resources. And I have it cited here, but not in front of me at the moment. But it does specifically say clean air. And so that's one of the arguments that this plaintiff is making. Now,
I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, is Massachusetts unique in the nation in that sense?
Not so far as I know so far. I don't know how many there are. I am now aware of a similar amendment to the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I think Pennsylvania is a Commonwealth. And frankly, that amendment, that article in Pennsylvania, was the ground of decision in a case within the last year or so in which the highest court, the Supreme Court, the state of Pennsylvania, invalidated certain fracking legislation based on that constitutional amendment, which is very interesting. But in this case, in the Massachusetts case, as I say, it's a little bit different. If you're here in the Pennsylvania case I just referenced, it was invalidation of legislation that had been passed by the state legislature permitting fracking virtually anywhere. And so they invalidated that legislation. In Massachusetts, the lawsuit doesn't seek to invalidate legislation. The child plaintiff's lawsuit seeks to force DEP to take some action to interpret the law that they have been, the DEP is authorized to interpret. So a public trust doctrine, I would say, in the case in Massachusetts, is most likely to fall behind the statutory interpretation.
In other words, you're saying that the judges will use the statutory thing as the so as not to muddy the waters of these deep public trust issues, right?
There's a principle of what's called constitutional avoidance, and courts will avoid tweaking and jiggering with the Constitution because, of course, it's such an important fundamental document if there's another ground of decision. In this case, while the plaintiffs have cited the public trust doctrine, And perhaps appropriately so. They've cited it in the complaint. They've mentioned it in the motion that triggered the hearing that was before Superior Court Justice Robert Gordon a couple of weeks ago. There is not much discussion of it in the actual pleadings themselves. All of the litigation really is toe-to-toe as to what the desired level means and whether or not DEP, which claims that it has created several regulatory schemes, including REGI, sulfur regulations, and the LEV, lowered emissions and vehicle regulations, which basically accomplish the same end that the plaintiffs are seeking. So I think in the Massachusetts case, the public trust doctrine is likely to fall behind that statutory ground when the case is ultimately decided.
Right. Although, I mean, I guess I will say for my own non-legalistic kind of view, there's a book that was written by a woman from the University of Oregon called Nature's Trust, where she does a lot of, proposing that this public trust doctrine be utilized as a theory for having all kinds of court cases that address environmental issues. I guess the question I have for you, Fran, is whether or not you see some kind of a coordinated campaign using that principle as something that might, over a decade or so, build to a credible legal theory. Is that something that happens, or is that something that is just a pipe dream?
My experience would be that with advocates in a certain field, they educate one another and they are aware of theories and approaches like this and will very likely seek to apply them in any situation that could possibly fall under this umbrella. Lawyers are obligated to state all their grounds of relief when they bring the lawsuit. And so as the plaintiffs did in Massachusetts, they will undoubtedly state the public trust doctrine and include it. And in the right case, the appeals court may well base an appeals court may well base a decision on the public trust doctrine if the facts are compelling and if the solution that the public trust doctrine provides solves that particular problem. Mm-hmm. I think that the public trust doctrine does not provide a perfect fit for air quality issues. Public trust doctrine, as I've defined it for you, comes purely out of land law. And understand that somebody has the land, has the right to the land, and they're litigating those rights. It's different with air quality. It's not so clear what the rights are, except, I would say, in a state that has an article or an amendment to the Constitution guaranteeing to the public that right to the to clean air. So mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, that that constitutional amendment gives a plaintiff in a public trust doctrine case a toehold to assert a right to be enforced before the court and to seek to apply the public trust solution to that particular problem.
So if I would, you did not say it, but I will, and that means that climate hawks in across the United States need to start a constitutional amendment to the United States Constitution guaranteeing clean air, which would then give a toehold at the national level.
I think that that
you don't have to agree or disagree.
But that could be an approach. I'm not aware of any environmental rights amendment to the Constitution. It could be found in a penumbra, I suppose, to one of the original articles.
By the penumbra, what do you mean?
That somehow that the language doesn't state it exactly, but within the reasoning and the understanding, for example, in the due process clause. With regard to rights to abortion, abortion is not stated there specifically, but the right to privacy that's found within the due process clause was the ground of decision with regard to abortion rights. So there could mm-hmm. be something that's found in there, but it certainly would be not a bad place to start in terms of seeking to establish a right that can then be injured. And that could be remedied by way of the public trust doctrine.
Well, thank you very much, Fran, for taking the time to talk. This has been a fascinating discussion of the legal. I have a feeling we're going to hear more about the public trust doctrine going forward. Thank you so much for giving us a grounding in it. We really appreciate your time, and we look forward to talking to you again.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Hawks Companion.